Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to these sessions. And I want to start by telling you my assignment in writing this book and then our procedure here. Just an aside to the people who are listening to this on tape 2 years or whatever from now, what I'm about to say overlaps what you've already heard in an earlier tape, but it's unavoidable because I now have a different audience. Now I'm back live. My purpose in this book was something that had not been attempted previously, and that is a proper academic presentation of objectivism. And that included many points which I deliberately tried to follow. Here are a few of the central ones that shaped my approach. One, the book had to be comprehensive. It had to give an overview of the total philosophy with all of the key interconnections. And it had to be written within the scope of a single book. In other words, it actually came out to being a little less than 500 pages. Thereby, you could get a view of the total philosophy as a unit, rather than an encyclopedia of 15 volumes, which would then have to be digested into a single book in order to grasp the total. Second, it had to include the important technical issues, but only if they are really important and provably so. This was not a book written for professional philosophers. I despise the idea of writing for professional philosophers. I believe that you should write for human beings. But this was not written for complete beginners either in regard to objectivism. It does presuppose Atlas Shrugged. Otherwise, the amount of new material would be excessive for a person to take in. They could maybe understand any given point, but the sheer quantity of points would be impossible. So that's the level of audience I was aiming at. Thirdly, if you want the whole before your mind as a single unit, including all the key technical explanations, you have to include only essentials. And that means that ruthless omission is necessary. The essential was judged by what is it I cannot get away with leaving out. If it's possible to leave it out, it was out. It's only if it was insistent, urgent, unavoidable, and permeated the total philosophy so that without it you simply couldn't get the philosophy that I included it. Now, I did include some elaborations and examples, so far as they were necessary for clarity, but I mostly suppressed massive amounts of elaborations, details, examples, secondary points, applications. It would be really easy to write 12 volumes on objectivism, one for each chapter in my book, but you would never know objectivism that way. You'd know Ayn Rand's theory of concept formation and her validation of the foundations of ethics and her view of rights, but it would be just a mass that you wouldn't be holding as a total. So the point is this: if a paragraph or a topic is in the book, that proves that I think it's important. And if it's not in, I don't. I doubt that I forgot some point, given the years that were involved in this. So if you don't understand why something is in or out, please ask, because either way, you should find it enlightening. Now, fourthly, with regard to the order, I think that is the greatest, if I say, I'm put in a position, let me say, where in order to be objective, I have to keep paying compliments to things in the book. I don't mean to make that to myself, but I don't know how else to say that there are certain things that you should look for because they're good. So with that preface, I just have to do it. The greatest virtue, I think, of the book is the structure. It's hierarchically structured, and that's the first time objectivism was ever presented that way. The sections themselves were chosen according to what's essential, and then the order of the sections and of the chapters, and so far as possible of the paragraphs within the sections were chosen by presupposing the previous all the way back to the axioms as the first sentence. So it should be clear to you at any point why any one section precedes any other. And if you would have organized it differently, There are certain options, but that probably means that we have a philosophic dispute, or that you're unclear about some aspect and you should ask. You should know about each section. Why is it there at all? And above all, why is it where it is rather than before or after? Now, with regard to polemics, polemics is your concern to refute your opponents rather than present your own viewpoint. I generally suppressed it all. I had long polemics at the early drafts, and I cut them. And finally, what I basically did with polemics, when I included them at all, is confine them to a little ghetto at the end of each chapter. Because it's non-essential, there was no space, and the more clear objectivism became to me, the less interested I was in refuting. I mean, I figured let them have, say whatever they wanted, it was too dull to do it. This is basically my attempt was to present objectivism positively as you would need it on a desert island. My concern was not what's wrong with religion and what's wrong with skepticism and what's wrong with altruism and communism. I tossed that off very briefly, but rather what's right and important with reality, reason, etc. Now, my method in the book for each point or principle that I introduce, I try to do four things for each, and you should therefore try to grasp these four. Make the point's meaning clear. What does it actually say? Whether it's the traitor principle or the primacy of existence or whatever it has, life is the standard. What is the meaning? And then secondly, what is the validation? How do you justify or validate or prove that point? Now, this doesn't always come right after the meaning. It might not come till the end of a section, but I somewhere have to get in the validation. And then I try to give some applications or examples so that it's not a floating abstraction, but just enough to keep it clear. And then finally, and very important, is integration. That is, I try to tie each point to the rest of the objectivist philosophy so that you get at least an indication that this is not simply another idea, but an idea inextricably interwoven in the total. Now, obviously, you could write a whole volume on how any one point is connected to every other point. You could just take any point out of a hat and then go through the whole objectivist philosophy. How is this point related to it? I couldn't do that. But I tried to get essential integrations in each case, and sometimes unusual ones. And that is essential to your grasping objectivism as a philosophy rather than just an individual point. And you should try to grasp these four if you can, or ask if you can't find one for any given topic. Now, the wording is highly calculated. It was edited about 10 times across 6 years, written and rewritten and re-rewritten, and the wording is often new, and I'm happy to entertain questions about why I worded something a certain way. If you're confused by a phrase or you find it clarifying, please feel free to tell me. But the only question I request is don't edit the book. No writer could survive 250 eager editors. Now, I mean by an editor someone who suggests a better formulation. Someone who says, wouldn't it have been clearer if you said A ought to be A instead of A is A, or whatever it happens to be. Now, I'm prepared to grant to you, sight unseen, that many changes of wording would make it clearer for you, or you, or you. And that if I wrote a book tailored to exactly what would be the clearest for you, it would not be this book. I grant you that. But before you write, you have to define the exact state of mind that you're writing for, and you have to keep that in mind as you write. And I had a very specific idea in mind. How much knowledge the person has, what motivation, what degree of intelligence, what methods of thinking did he and didn't he know? And basically, I projected myself as I was 20 or 25 years ago. And that's who I was writing This is what I would have found clarifying when I was younger. And the only changes that I entertained in editing from other people were those that would make it clearer to that particular state of mind. I don't think anybody can write for anybody other than themselves, basically. And now I'm happy to say, delighted to say, it's too late even to make that kind of change. Because the book is being actually bound as we speak. So I couldn't make changes now, even if I were desperate to, which I am not. So you're stuck with the wording as it is. And I appreciate if you could... it's irresistible when you find a formulation that you think is better to suggest it, but it's hopeless. It's a lost cause. I won't even entertain it. Now, these seminars start with chapter 6. The first 5 I covered elsewhere, and that's available on tape. So obviously I have to presuppose those, and that is the entire objective is metaphysics and epistemology. I'm circulating the table of contents so you can get an idea what is covered, but just to rattle it off for the record, chapter 1 deals with reality and lays down the axioms, law of causality, the primacy of existence, the metaphysical versus the man-made. If that means something to you, great, and if it doesn't, I can't even give a thumbnail sketch now because that would wipe out our whole seminar. Chapter 2 deals with sense perception and volition, the validity of the senses, the issue of consciousness having identity, the nature of free will as a choice to focus or not, the relation between volition and causality. Chapter 3 is concept formation, and that's basically the whole of Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. Role of mathematics, measurement, omission, definitions, unit economy. Chapter 4 is objectivity. That's, by the way, the best chapter, in my opinion, in the book, because I bring together in one chapter things that were never brought together before, and has a beautiful logical flow to it, if I say so myself. But it includes concepts as objective, a detailed analysis of objectivity, the role of logic, knowledge as contextual, knowledge as hierarchical, and then in the polemical thing at the end, the subjective and the intrinsic. And then 5 is called reason, and it's basically deals with what is reason, relation of reason and emotions, what's wrong with mysticism, and perhaps the most important sequence in there, which we'll be alluding to many times, is the issue of the arbitrary, why the arbitrary is neither true nor false, and certainty, and the issue of certainty as contextual. Now, at one point or another through the book, I have these brief, by brief I mean 4 or 5 pages, polemics against materialism, idealism, all the various theories on sense perception, the standard ones, determinism, intrinsicism, subjectivism, mysticism, skepticism. So all those isms get denounced. But now, I take for granted you know all this, right? Everything I've said so far, because that's what we're taking for granted as we turn to chapter 6, which is where we begin. By the way, just to correct something that Dr. Riesman said last night, the book does not end with the last chapter. There's 2 more after what we're doing. One is on art, and then, well, it's called an epilogue, but it's really the philosophy of history as seen by objectivism. All right, now let's turn to chapter 6, and I'm going to start each session with a brief indication of some points of interest. And then we will work through one subsection at a time. Now, we have to cover 1 chapter per session. Now, this is a long introduction by me today, which will not exist in other meetings, and it's happily compensated by the fact that it's a very short chapter. Now, 7 and 8 are pretty long chapters, but happily, sections of them have been covered in earlier meetings of the Jefferson School and are available, the discussions on tape, so I feel quite content to omit material that I've offered at previous Jefferson schools, unless you have some new points that you want to talk about. But I hesitate to charge for repetition. And given those omissions, I think we'll be able to average one chapter per session, not necessarily exactly, but on the whole. All right, now let's look at chapter 6. My remarks will be shorter or longer according as I have something to say or I don't. This is where we turn to man. Now you may say, well, haven't you covered man in all the earlier chapters? And actually, we have not. In the earlier chapters on epistemology, we covered consciousness. How does a volitional consciousness operate? How does it acquire knowledge? What steps should it follow? That is a faculty of man. But it's here is where we go from the faculty to the entity that possesses the faculty. And therefore, we get to a more complex stage of knowledge, where we put together whatever we learned about this one attribute with other observable attributes of man in order to end up with the picture of the total entity, which is then what leads us into ethics. Now, the best way to explain the substance of this chapter is to contrast it. You know, I started by editing a 1976 course which I gave, which I suppose most of you have heard that course one way or the other. It's the Philosophy of Objectivism course. How many have heard that course? Yeah, well, then that's what you were basically brought up on. And the book is way ahead of the course in terms of hierarchical structure. And I would like here to contrast what I do with the chapter of man and what I did with the corresponding lecture, because that'll highlight the structural issues involved. Now, the old course, the 76 course, started with a chapter on man. Started with a lecture on man. Now, I knew at the time that that was out of order. I didn't think philosophy started. In fact, that was Ayn Rand's suggestion, because people used to take one lecture and then decide whether to enroll for the course or not. And I hated to start with something abstruse like reality, because it cut down on later registration. So Ayn Rand said, why don't you start with man and then go back to what it rests on and forward to what it leads to? So I said, great. So I started with man, and I knew that that was a commercial, not a hierarchical decision. But the question is, given that you're talking about man as a topic, what comes under it? Now, I've put on the board there, if you can read it, the six main topics that I considered at that time in 1976 essential to a discussion of what is man and properly as belonging under it. Man, and those were the order that I offered them in. Man survives by reason. Reason and emotion, that's the issue, that emotions are products of your ideas. The integration of mind and body, which I took as a generalization from reason and emotion. Reason as an attribute of the individual. Man has free will, the issue of volition versus determinism. And then I ended with the role of philosophy in man's life. Man as a being who needs philosophy to survive. Now, let's go over that list today from the perspective of the book. The first question I would say, looking at the first one, man survives by reason. I just plunged in. Well, he survives by reason, and you know, I was taking it from Rourke's speech and just went from there. What logically or hierarchically question do you have to ask before you say how he survived? I remember we haven't said anything about this topic yet. We've just had metaphysics and epistemology. Yes. No, not what is man. That's what we're doing. But this is a sub-question within what is man. Before you talk about his means of survival, not what is the means of survival of this book? Well, you might say advertising, but that's equivocation. This book has no means of survival. Why not? It's not alive, right? Only a living organism needs a means of survival. So before you talk about how anything survives, you first have to identify a fundamental fact, namely that man is a living organism. And that, of course, takes you to the question, what is life? What is it to be a living organism? That is the fundamental when you turn to man. Now, when you discuss consciousness under epistemology, Whether it's living or inanimate doesn't come up because we're abstracting away just a certain mental process. But when we look at man, the first thing to say about him is that he is a living organism. That's the fundamental category, the fundamental bifurcation in the universe between the living and the non-living. And by fundamental, we mean that on which the greatest number of differences depend. And thus, the very first section under man is living organisms as whatever it was, goal-directed and so on. Now, in my original 76 course, I covered man as a living entity, but does anybody remember where it was covered? It was tossed in under ethics. I was going to get to life as the standard of value, so I said it parenthetically. Just before we get there, what is life, etc., etc., now we go back to ethics. Now, I think one of my best points was to separate as two different chapters, because they are hierarchically two different points. What is a living organism? And then, how does life relate to value? Those are two separate questions. One is the nature of man, and the other goes under the good, the nature of value. And if you keep that separation, you'll find when you get to the chapter on ethics and the good, it's just a breeze. You read it right off of the preceding chapter on the nature of a living organism, which becomes much clearer when you don't have to carry the added freight of proving a standard of value before you even know what you're talking about. So I'm very pleased with this division now. I think that's one of the good hierarchical discoveries here. Now, after that, you can then go to man survives by reason, because that follows logically. Now, reason and emotion, I've decided, does not belong under man at all, in the sense in which we're using. Obviously, we're talking about human beings. But that properly, I believe, comes earlier. It completes the survey of consciousness as an attribute, which is really what epistemology is. Consciousness, it studies consciousness as the attribute for cognition. And in order to have a full understanding of consciousness as the faculty of cognition, you have to know that it has certain, there are consequences of your conceptual content that are not themselves cognitive. You have to know that consciousness is a cognitive entity or a faculty, the result of which produces certain other phenomena of consciousness which are not themselves cognitive, and that emotions are the primary things in that category. And therefore, this topic of reason and emotion is necessary to conclude an analysis of what is cognition and what isn't. So you need to know that emotions are not tools of cognition in order to know fully what is cognition, and that therefore comes under epistemology. By the time you get to study man, it's taken for granted. We know that. Now, as to the mind and body issue, that goes way back earlier. Partly I cover that under metaphysics, because I argue that the dichotomy arises from the primacy of consciousness, from people who expect reality to obey them, and then it doesn't. And the result is they feel a conflict between in here and out there, which becomes the mind-body dichotomy. Therefore, partly that's treated way back in chapter one. And partly that dichotomy in the form, for instance, of theory versus practice comes from people whose idea of concepts is completely detached from percepts. They have floating concepts. And consequently, they have clashed continuously between what they think should be and what actually is. And so they get the theory-practice dichotomy, which feeds into the other one. And that, therefore, goes into the earlier discussion of cognition and concept formation. So by the time you get to man, I've thoroughly blasted the mind-body dichotomy and established the integration so there would be no more topic. I think it's a page or so just to say in this chapter, just to say, by the way, this is still true. But that's basically all I say, and if you'll notice, that page is mostly polemical. It's basically trying to imagine the opposite. You see, there's nothing to say once you have the right metaphysics and epistemology. It just wouldn't occur to you to say, And now let me show that there's no clash between them. It would be like saying your faculty of smell and your pancreas. Now I'm going to have a section on why there's no clash. I mean, it just wouldn't come up. I mean, unless your pancreas is supernatural. Now, reason as an attribute of the... Oh, wait a minute. Next was... reason as an attribute of the individual. Right. And that's fine. That belongs here. Because this is the type of level where we can talk about one man versus a group, you see. It becomes irrelevant to talk about an individual versus a group until we even know what consciousness is and how to acquire knowledge. But now we look around and we see there's more than one man. And therefore we want to know, given this faculty of survival, reason, to whom does it pertain? To what? Is there one giant, you know, human coral bush or what? So now it's appropriate. Now, as far as volition, I decided long ago that volition goes way back. Volition is a precondition of all philosophic advice. I wouldn't say of all philosophy, because you properly have to say existence exists first. That is, the chapter on reality comes first. But from the time you start epistemology, you're giving advice. You're telling people you should, you know, form concepts this way and definitions this way and use logic and be objective. And there's no shoulds if there's no choice. Therefore, substantially, I believe that until you establish free will, the only thing you could do is say existence exists. And therefore, at the very beginning of epistemology, I cover free will. And then finally, the role of philosophy in man's life. Well, that obviously does not belong under the nature of man. First, you'd have to know what is philosophy, and what is man's life, and you'd have to see them intersect if you're going to be able to prove that. So, actually, the only way to prove the role of philosophy in man's life is at the end of a book or a sequence, not at the beginning. Now, what I do is at the beginning, I give a brief definition and a page of propaganda, which for motivational purposes, to tell people, if you hang in there, it's really going to be important. But of course, that doesn't cut any weight and has no meaning to anybody. The real argument for the role of philosophy in man's life is at the end of the book. And actually, under what topic does it really come, which is a surprise to me, it works out very nicely. It comes under art. Because the whole thing of art is that it satisfies man's need of philosophic guidance, you see. So it just worked out beautifully that art is the end, and it's also where you prove the role of philosophy. And then to hammer it home, I threw in the epilogue, which was the philosophy of history, to show how it actually worked out historically. But in any event, it's absurd and bizarre to stick it in the middle under the nature of man. You know, I mean, because if you say, my argument in 76 was, well, man can't survive without philosophy. So this must be part of his nature, but by the same argument, I could have had a dissertation on food. You know, he can't survive without food, but you wouldn't say man is an eating creature, you know. So we're left, really, if you separate the entity or distinguish the entity from the faculty of consciousness, we're left with three essential topics. And you'll see that's exactly how it's structured. They presuppose what came earlier, and they make possible what comes later. And just to look ahead, I assume have you read right through, or are you reading one chapter a day? Well, if you've read right through, you'll see that how well it fit into ethics, because man as a living being correlates directly with life as the standard. And reason as a means of survival, with rationality as the primary virtue, and reason as an attribute of the individual, with the topic of egoism. So there's an ethical reflection of each of those points, and then of course if you look further in politics, that becomes a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So this, I mean, I'm not a Hegelian, I don't place a special value on the number three, but it just worked out very nicely that way. Now, one other question that I'm frequently asked, why do you say reason is man's basic means of survival? And I ask that, why the word basic? Why not just his means of survival? And I asked that of Miss Rand, and she said, well, every organism, every organ, every attribute of a living entity is part of its means of survival. Your legs help you to survive, and your heart is indispensable to your survival, etc. Nothing in a living entity can be superfluous. And in that sense, they're all, every aspect is a means of survival. But she said reason is basic in the sense that it underlies the proper use of everything within his volition. It enables the entity to function as a total in a pro-life way, and it's the only faculty which does. It's the one that enables him to stay in contact with reality, you see, and thereby direct all of his organs and faculties and so on. Without that, he's in a position of, he's got a lot of things that can survive used correctly, but he doesn't know how to use them. So it's the underlying, the big gun within his means of survival, and that's why she called it, it's like a driver in an automobile. Now the tire is essential to him driving. If he has a blowout, he can't drive. But the driver is more basic than the tire. You know, in the sense that without the driver, it's hopeless. Whereas, you know, with a bad tire, the driver can manage, you know, to get to a garage, hopefully. All right, let's just turn quickly to the first sequence and see if there's anything I've felt I had to say. We'll take them one at a time. And the first one starts on 283. Living organisms as goal-directed and conditional. And I think I'll just point out to you on page 285, there is a polemics here, but it's an important polemics. In answer to reductionism, how many of you know what reductionism is? That's the idea in this context that life is really a myth, that there's only inanimate objects and a living organism can be reduced to, shown to be nothing but, you know, a collection of parts reacting and interreacting. And this paragraph, let us, for purposes of convenience, agree to this convention. The top part of a paragraph will be paragraph one. See, for instance, on page 285, paragraph one starts, is the essence of death. I'm going to call that one. Therefore, now I want you to go to paragraph four on 285. That comes pretty much out of Ayn Rand's mouth itself. I heard her say that many times, so I just want to call that to your attention. There's an awful lot like that in the book that's directly from her, but not in quotes because I can't literally vouch for the wording, but I can hear her saying it time after time. And I remember numbers of times that people would say to her, oh, if only we knew, you know, the roots of life and where it came from, then we could once and for all, validate the objectivist ethics and answer these people who say that life is a myth. And she would say with some heat, as you could probably project, the ultimate explanation doesn't make any difference. And she left open whether there was some unknown element which combined with matter as we now know it, or nothing but some special combination of known material ingredients. But she would stress whatever leads to it doesn't make any difference because it is here. And once it's here, its existence and its nature are facts. And nothing is going to erase those facts. And then that was her line. An explanation does not erase the reality, it explains. So if you can explain something, so far from that proving reduction, it proves the opposite. Now then most of the rest of this page are polemics. I think it's worth doing, but I won't say further. And then I just point out to you what I think is a good sentence on the top of 286. The difference between between matter and living organism. The one can become inanimate, the other already is. And that is the great divide in nature. Death is nothing but a living organism becoming inanimate. If you keep that in mind, I don't think you'll have problems with this idea that, well, man is just a collection of atoms in motion, so how does that differ destroying a man or burning down a house? You're just rearranging the molecules, so what's the difference? And the difference is that they cross that metaphysical divide. It goes from being animate to being inanimate, and there's no greater change. And that's really the only essential change possible, because you can't go from being inanimate to being nothing. There is no nothing. And therefore, that is the fundamental metaphysical divide. And that, of course, is why to be or not to be is the fundamental question, and why the essence of life is that it's conditional. Okay, now I'll give you a chance to ask questions on this opening material through the living organisms as goal-directed and conditional. You have to wave your hand so I can see. And I'm going to arbitrarily cut it off at a certain point so we can go through the other two sections. Yes?
On the last point you talked about recently, do the reductionists believe death makes no difference?
Yeah. All right. A true reductionist believes that death makes no difference. All he would say is, well, death makes an empirical difference. For instance, if you take a man and you put a knife in his heart, you can observe. He stops moving. He lies on his back. The blood comes trickling. Then it congeals. Then he turns cold. Then somebody digs a hole. So in that way, he would say death makes a difference. But it's no more different than any other difference. It's just a difference in form. It's exactly the same kind of difference as if you swallow your oatmeal, you know, or you go for a ride in a car, or a rock rolls down a hill. It's all exactly the same. It's just a change of matter from one physical location to another without any metaphysical divide being crossed. In that sense, a reductionist thinks it's correct. Now, they will deny that, you know, because when you have an evasive position, they will evade all over the place. But if you could force them to say it, they would say that death makes no difference, exactly. Exactly the way that their equivalents in psychology say mind makes no difference, the behaviorist. You're just a brain and a nervous system, and mind is just a myth. Well, that's what these people, these are like the behaviorists in biology. I will take the back if you wave, though, but I can't see you if you don't wave. Okay, somewhere here, yes.
When you use the term living organisms, are you using that to differentiate from non-living organisms?
Or no, that happens to be a phrase like individual right, you know, where it is a redundancy, but it's not one invented by me. And there are contexts where either of rhythm or of emphasis, that the word organism sounds too arcane or too scientific, and you want to stress that this thing is alive. So I just followed in the same way that rights are only individuals' possessions, but sometimes you want to hit people over the head with that. So there are what you call laissez-faire capitalism. There are permissible redundancies, as long as you're not too redundant in using them. Yes?
In your definition of love, is what I'm interested in, you define it, and Ayn Rand, it as a self-sustaining process, but there are other processes that one can think of which are apparently self-sustaining, for instance, the sun. But we know that that's not love.
Wait, well, how is the sun self-sustaining?
Well, I'm not a physicist, but as I understand...
In fact, I understand the sun is dissipating, and in so many trillion years, it's going to be gone. It's pouring out energy or something.
But then, most living organisms, all of them, also dissipate.
So, okay, well, so we're back at a standoff then. So how is the sun self-sustaining? You mean it's been around a long time? Is that what you mean?
Well, there's a process that goes on in it, which sustains the action that it takes. It burns up and gives out light.
Oh, well, I mean, there's all kinds of things that are a continuous process. But we're talking about a very specific thing. First of all, you didn't entirely quote Ayn Rand's statement. Life is a process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. Now, self-generated action is very essential there. It's not simply that it takes certain action as a means to the end of keeping itself in existence, but that it does not do so by passive reaction to anything external to itself. It actually generates, it needs the material, of course, it needs the, you know, to be fed the chemicals and so on, but what it does with those is generated from within itself. And this is not original with Ayn Rand, by the way, it goes all the way back to the Greeks. And life was always regarded as the self-starting entity. And then the self-sustaining is simply why it has to be self-starting, because if it doesn't take this action, it will perish. Now, that is very different from any other type of entity, whether it's the sun, which is debatable to me whether the sun is even an entity. It's a swirling mass of gases. But I want to go one step further, because maybe this is what's confusing you. And Ayn Rand surprised me once by telling me, I said to her something like, now given your definition of life, wouldn't so and so, and she said to me, where is my definition of life? And I said, well, self-sustaining and self-generated action. She said, that's not a definition. I said, it isn't? She said, no. A definition is supposed to tell you the essence of a certain type of entity. I am not a biologist. I can't tell you what life is, what type of structure, what type of elements distinguish the living from the rest of the world. All I can do from the point of view of a philosophic observer is say, this mode of action is distinct from a piece of chalk or a rock or, whatever the inanimate things we observe. And therefore, I will use that as a description in order to identify the role of this type of thing in relation to values and so on. But she never claimed that that was a definition of life. It was a philosophic description. Now, you are raising interesting points there, which I'm cavalierly going over, but I feel happy to go by because this is one of the few topics in all of philosophy where an entire book has been written to elaborate the objectivist view on exactly the question you're raising. And the title of your book, Harry, again, is The Teleological Basis of... No. The Biological Basis of... Where's Harry? Is Harry here? No. Oh, what is it? Biological Basis of... Teleological Concepts. Written by Dr. Harry Binswanger. Fascinating, very enjoyable book, which takes these concepts of self-sustaining and self-generated one point at a time, and then it gives counterexamples and answers them. And I wish I knew it well enough to rattle off everything in there, but if you're interested, definitely read that book. But it's a good question. I just, yes.
Yeah, page 284, third paragraph, you talk about, living organisms initiate a consistent kind of action, and you say shortly thereafter that this is the sense in which their action is goal-directed.
Right.
What is the relationship between the consistency in their actions and the concept of goal-directed?
Well, if their action was not consistent, it would not be goal-directed. The consistency is that they are so built that every aspect, part, and process and sub-process within them leads to a certain result. The same one result. All work together. Now, you see, what we want to get away from is the idea of goal-directed in the conscious sense. It's not as though the liver sits back and says, well, today I'm going to manufacture so-and-so because I know the pancreas will need it tomorrow. In that sense, it's not goal-directed, if you take goal in the conscious way. But in contrast to the type of thing that just reacts randomly to whatever forces, if you push it left, it goes left. If you push it right, it goes right. A living thing, by analogy, let's say it wants to go left, on its own it will grow left, and if you push it right, it'll try to grow around the rock, for instance, around the plant to go around the rock to get back to the sun. So whatever environment you put it in, if it's capable of functioning at all, it will continue to take a certain kind of action. The action is self-generated and consistent. Consistent meaning all in the direction of a certain goal. But that doesn't mean it's aware of the goal. It's just so built that it has no option but to initiate this type of direction. That?
In terms of to to understand the process of goal directed, you have to see, you have to understand the factors behind its consistency, or understand all the factors.
No, you do not have to understand all the factors, because I don't understand all the factors, and I feel I understand the concept of goal directed. But I'll grant you this much. To understand goal directed, you first have to know it on the human level. You could not get that concept by just observing plants. You'd first have to grasp it in terms of conscious beings, and obviously first in terms of human beings, because that's the simplest and blatant. I'm hungry, I want to eat, there's the food, I walk across the room, I have a goal, I know what it is, and that directs my action. And then you see that animals who are unable to conceptualize, can't speak, and don't know what they're doing in the sense of, you know, they have no introspective ability, are hungry, and they walk across the room, and you see, oh, they're goal-directed too, the same idea. And then you see, if you're a biologist or an observer, that this plant is reaching its roots this way to get the water rather than this way, and whatever obstacle you put in, it keeps going, and you see that it's exactly the same as against you stick a top, you know, in the ground, and it just sits there and rusts. So you see that it's goal-directed also, not in the sense even of the animal that it has a goal, but in the sense that when it's automatically left alone, it operates in a consistent fashion. These are good questions, but Harry Binsmacher should be giving this seminar because he's a specialist in it. So when he gives a class, ask him these questions. Yes?
Why is the fact that life begets life not included in the definition? Is it because it's not true of all?
Well, you can't tell me that. Why is it not included in the definition when I just said this wasn't a definition?
As the essential of the concept of life.
I don't know that it's an essential. But certainly I think more essential than that would be that life has a certain kind of cellular structure. But the whole point is that this is not a definition. This is a description of a mode of action. And there's, I think, a lot of things that are true of living organisms. It would be up to a biologist to decide. That's precisely why she didn't offer a definition. To offer a definition, you would have to make a detailed study of life. And philosophy does not make a detailed study of anything, except mental aberrations. What?
Don't you need a definition in order to use the concept
No,
at all?
You do not. You need to be able to demarcate what you're talking about and how you're differentiating it within a certain context. You don't need to have a full scientific definition in order to be able... the same is true of matter, by the way. There's nothing distinctive to life about this. Only a physicist could give you a proper definition of matter. But that doesn't mean we don't know what we mean by matter if we're using it as philosophers. Then we can say matter is that of which, and I point to all of this, is composed. What is it? Ask a physicist. But it's perfectly clear what I'm talking about within the limits of philosophy. Within the limits, remember, philosophy is a subject that pertains to knowledge available to man at every stage of human development. It cannot be specialized. It's the base of all specialized knowledge. So as soon as you try to push me into a study of life or a study of matter, then it's outside of philosophy. Then it's science. And you would be in a logical circle because you'd have to have philosophy to get science off the ground. So you can't take out of context, you're arguing like this. If you don't have a definition, the term is meaningless. But the term matter and life and so on are ostensive for us as philosophers, and we can give enough of a characterization so that we know exactly what is and isn't included and from what aspect we're talking about them. But that doesn't mean we have done for them what we do for man, for instance, which is the topic of philosophy. We haven't given an equivalent definition in terms of essentials. But that doesn't mean the term is like gloop. Now, however, a physicist using matter, using the term without any further definition, and then starting to talk about whether matter is or isn't conserved, is in the position of a disaster, because that's his field and he doesn't know what he's talking about. All right, I think with that, I'm going to jump ahead to... At the end, if I miscalculate and we have time left, we can go back over the whole. Let's look at reason as man's basic means of survival. And I think that if an entire sentence is in italics, that would give you a clue that I regard that as important, so I don't have to stress that. But I would like to tell you that I tried to be very careful with the words or and not to use them unless there were two different points. You know, in speaking, you will say, he's nice and great and wonderful, you know, and just till you finally hit on some combination that gets across the thought. But in writing, you should not use or and unless you really have two different points to make. And I tried to challenge every one of those, which was in itself difficult. But if you see, as for instance, on 286 near the bottom in italics, man cannot function or survive. Now, I'm making two different points. And I mean, that, if that or survived, it meant that I thought both of those were essential. What is the fundamental there of those two terms in this context? No. No. Survive is a consequence. Man cannot function. He cannot act at all. He cannot do anything or get anywhere if he goes merely by sensations or percepts. Now, obviously, as a baby, as an infant, he can, because that's all he's got. But once he reaches the conceptual level, if you deprive him of his conceptual knowledge, he's completely helpless. It's tantamount to being in a coma. He can react, you know, if you tap his patellar reflex or produce just a physical reaction, but he does not have the mechanism to act as a conceptual being without conceptual guidance. And that's the crucial point. The survive is a consequence, which happens to be the one that interests me because I'm thinking of him as a living organism and I have my eye on life as the standard. But that's just a consequence. Since he can't function, he can't achieve any goal, including the all-important goal of remaining alive. So I'm putting that in almost as anticipation. But the important point is that he cannot function. You see, and that's the direct attack on the idea of instinct. That, you know, you just have to let this thing well up in you and you just automatically move and start to act. That is the idea that he can function by the guidance of sensations or percepts. Of course, they call it instinct and dress it up as something mystical, but it still comes down to it's a non-conceptual mode of functioning for a conceptual being. And that's exactly what Ayn Rand denies completely. Now, just jump over to 287. Well, if we call that little tiny paragraph on the top one, then it's 1, 2, 3, 4. The conclusion is evident. Now, here is a little example of a hierarchical structure. If somebody asks you, reason is man's tool of survival, is that an axiom? And you say, obviously that is not an axiom. Why is it not an axiom? Well, what is one obvious reason why that can't be an axiom? What is the most obvious reason? Somebody knew if I... You have to wave, though. Yeah.
Babies can
survive. Which?
Babies can survive.
No, no, they can't. Babies can't survive except through adults. So, I want to know why this is not an axiom. This is a complex derivation. How does this differ from ASA, which is an axiom? See, a lot of people think, well, this is an objectivist bromide, so it must be an axiom. But a bromide does not make it an axiom, yes?
Well, you could, I mean, for one thing, there were many billions of years when there were no men, but there were still only elements.
Well, how about that? What would that prove?
I mean, A was A.
Oh, A is A, yeah. No, no. But why is this statement, man's reason is man's basic tool of survival, not an axiom?
Well,
I just heard the answer over here, one answer. Reason is a tremendously advanced and sophisticated concept. That is not an axiomatic concept. I had a whole chapter on reason, which I could only put in chapter 5, because I had to first discuss the perceptual data that reason organizes, and then the conceptual form in which it organizes them, and then the logical objective method by which it proceeds. So you need at least those three things before you can get to reason. So reason is already a late discovery. A child can't even grasp what reason is in the philosophic sense. And then that it's his tool of survival takes a tremendous amount more. First, and that's what I spell out here, first you have to know that reason is your means of knowing reality. And all of epistemology is required to establish that. And then you have to discover that man is an organism and that he survives by means of his knowledge. And then you put it all together and finally say reason is man's basic tool of survival. So you see, Rourke's speech, although it starts basically with that idea, starts at least halfway through Ayn Rand's philosophy. And she was very aware of that at the time, but he couldn't, in the context of that trial, go into the process of concept formation. Now, here is we're taking the time. The bottom of 287, right near the bottom. The Industrial Revolution, you see the second last paragraph? It's demonstrated once and for all the tie between, and then I put them in all these different ways to try to capture different aspects. Science and wealth is like a sociological description. Innovation and longevity, well, I was thinking of psychology and biology, the type of psychology that leads to innovation and then longevity. Knowledge and power, that's who? That's the traditional formulation of Francis Bacon. And then, of course, concepts and survival, that is last because that is the distinctively objectivist way of putting it. So by putting it this way, you see, you have made the point from a number of different perspectives. And so you've used the knowledge that people have but don't congeal into a firm principle, and then by the time you hit the nail on the head fully between concepts and survival, it flows as though it's just inevitable, you see. But the world would have been very different if Bacon had said, concepts are survival. But he said, knowledge is power. Now, far be it from me to criticize him because he's, was an immortal genius, and that statement alone justified 10 lives. But I'm just trying to point out to you that there is a difference, even though they're very related, between his formulation and Ayn Rand's, and his is evadable. Hers is not. Well, I mean, certain people could evade anything, but. Now, just one last brief observation here. The bottom of 288, the last paragraph. The principle of mind-body integration rests on observation. And that is very important methodologically. All philosophy has to go back to observation. All philosophy. And therefore, no matter what you're talking about, you should be able to say what observations ultimately lead to it. And I have tried throughout, on the more abstract stuff to go back every time to, for instance, I don't say the principle of mind-body integration derives from the theory of consciousness has identity. Now, what fallacy would I be committing if I were to say that? Yeah.
Rationalistic.
Yes, I would be rationalistic. I would be trying to deduce without reference to reality. And that is one thing that Ayn Rand did not do. She every time I worked out a deductive proof, she would say to me, well, maybe not every time, but because there is, after all, a certain use of deduction, but many, many times she would say to me, why do you want to construct those, tremendous constructs? Can't you just look at reality and see the point? And, of course, unfortunately, I couldn't because I was all mixed up, but I tried finally to get it all untangled where if you say mind-body integration, your mind does not go to, well, let me see, what other principles do we know that we could deduce it from? But it goes to things like, I want to raise my hand, and my hand goes up, that's it. You know, now if I wanted to raise my hand and it just sat there, that might be a disease. But if it did it that with everybody, you'd say we've got a real problem with the mind-body dichotomy, but we'd be dead. I mean, there would be no such species, so you wouldn't have the problem. The same is true as reason is a practical faculty. That is not a deduction from her theory of reason or from anybody's definition of practicality. It's a question of try and see. You want to walk across the street, and you want to do it by reason or not by reason, by perceiving reality or by just closing your eyes, and then you'll find out which is practical. I mean, those are the observations that all of these principles have to subsume in your mind, and that's why the best way to, if you were studying this book or studying objectivism, can you tie every point to observation? Now, in my introductory remarks, I was saying it's important to tie each point to every other. That's a different kind of tying. That's integration within the system. That's because my goal here is to present the system as a whole. But to use it and live by it, that's the part I call the validation. You have to be able to see directly what in reality, what observations give rise to it. And whenever you feel, well, I don't see exactly what in reality gives rise to, but I know how to deduce it from another thing that I saw, that's already a mistake. All right, are there questions on this one? Yes, Phil.
A question for what you just said about the book itself, integration within the system, and your concern in the book, mentioned in the introduction, to make everything hierarchical. And I'm wondering whether there is a way to write an entire book on objectivism that is through and through hierarchical and one that is through and through inductive.
No, I know your answer. You think of your question. He says, I've written a book that's through and through hierarchical, in effect concerned with the interrelation of the ideas. But what about, could somebody write a book on objectivism that was through and through inductive and that stressed the observational basis in reality for this? Well, that's the same book. Because what does hierarchical mean? Hierarchical means this depends on this, depends on this. You take it back until you reach what? Direct observation. So, properly speaking, any one of these points, you should be able to slide all the way back down until you can point directly to reality. And in that sense, hopefully, the base or the means of grasping the underlying observations is present in the structure. Now, what you could do, though, which I didn't do, is write a book which gave 100 examples where I gave one, which would have a value as chewing. You see, you could see this point, which I just hit and run, has applications everywhere, and it would really help concretize it. But then what you would lose is the total, you see. You'd have to do that only on the basis of a book like this.
Maybe induction is the wrong word, but I meant a book in which the first section is not a very abstract topic like metaphysics and epistemology, but is man.
You're editing. No, if you want to write a different book, you can write it, but don't rearrange it right now. What I did want to say is this. Those of you who did not read chapter 4, I argue there that there are two different processes required for something to be knowledge. One is integration and one is reduction. And integration is where you cross-connect a point to all the other points you believe. And reduction is where you take the point itself step by step back to sensory data. Now, I tried to do that in this book by validation and integration on each point. But the theory and practice of that, I refer you to chapter 4, which works that out systematically. That's why I think it's the best chapter. All right, somebody new that has a question on this sequence, anybody? Was that because it's too unintelligible or too intelligible? Wait. Yes.
More general question. All of your chapter subtitles have the form A as B, And I wonder, did you choose that formulation to shed the objectivist perspective on commonly used concepts?
Well, I chose that because each of them is really a proposition. Reason is man's basic means of survival. But I didn't like the is because it came across as an assertion ahead of any argument, you know, like this is the dogma, you know. So instead I wanted a literary form that would introduce the topic. So here, we're now going to discuss reason as so-and-so. So it's the same idea. You could change all the as's to is's, but I was trying to avoid that. There's a dogmatic feel to just, you know, a big, bold-faced proposition. True or false, do you agree with, you know, the religion or not? And it was, that was only the only reason for that. Okay, well then I'll go on. Is that, you have no questions because it's too obvious, is that it, or it's too what? It's too obvious, oh, okay. I don't know if that's good or bad. Reason as an attribute of the individual is the last section. Now let me ask you a question if it's obvious. On the top of 290, top paragraph, the last sentence there. Mindless recitation of truths reached by others is not cognition. Why not? I know that you know, because you sit right in the front in the middle. And I'm trying to find somebody that's more devious. Yes.
Well, the fact that you can memorize and regurgitate something doesn't mean that you grasp it or can apply it.
Well, that's true, but you're basically restating it. You're making it even more plausible by restatement. But I want to know why does the fact that you can regurgitate it, why does that not make it... what if it's really true? What if, for instance, you hear man should live for his own sake? You hear Ayn Rand or Mir, whoever, say that, and or somebody hears that. They don't know why, they couldn't care less, they say, okay, and then they go around saying you should live for your own sake. So that's mindless recitation of truths reached by others. Wouldn't that help them? Why is that not cognition? They know the right way to live now. Why not?
You have to integrate.
What?
Integrate.
Well, you say they haven't integrated. Okay, but that means they don't know anything but everything, but at least they know that much. They know they shouldn't sacrifice and that they should pursue their own goals. So they got something, right? So that's okay then.
Well, no, to recite it is not okay.
Why?
They haven't integrated it.
But let's say they've integrated it and they apply it up to a certain point, as much as they can get. He knows enough not to listen to the Fuhrer when the Fuhrer tells him to kill himself. He says, no, you should live for yourself. I'm not going to do that. So he got something out of it, right? Yeah, it's right in the middle.
So, you talk about mindless recitation. So, for it to be cognition, for it to be an aid to his survival, it should be mindful.
Correct. Why?
Of all the reasons that have been stated beforehand.
But even if it's true, though, why can't you sort of, you know, borrow somebody else's truth? I'm looking for one word, that's it. One word that's really essential to the objectivism. I mean, there's a lot of different people would say, of course, that's true, but I'm looking for the objectivist perspective. The one, yeah. Right. That is the arbitrary. That's exactly what the arbitrary is. Recitation of ideas by others, which may very well be true, but the point is that in the reciter's mind, it is not true. Even if he can act in certain instances on it. It's analogous if you took the lectures to the parrot uttering sounds and it's tremendously harmful to his long-range functioning, because if he permits the arbitrary, there's no way to correct it. If you make a mistake, but use the right method, you can always correct it, you know, when new data comes in. But if you succumb to the arbitrary, it's deuce as well. There's no way any longer to ever rectify your mental process, because you have no way of knowing what you're accepting or why or what, you know, you would change. You basically severed your mind from reality. And that's what was really interesting to me in writing the book, was how important the issue of the arbitrary is to objectivism. Now, I had lectured on, you know, objectivism for years. And I had always thought that Ayn Rand's theory, that the arbitrary is neither true nor false, was a really interesting theory, but just, you know, one idea. And I remember when I gave the 76 course, I felt, I got to include this somewhere because it's an original idea. I didn't have any idea where to include it. And it was just sort of like a curiosity, you know, to be sure that people got their money's worth, I'll put this one in too. As I was writing this book, it was the first time I realized how essential that is to the whole epistemology and to the whole philosophy. The number of times thereafter, throughout the book, after that section, I kept coming up to, well, the answer is, the arbitrary is neither true nor false. I thought, this is uncanny. This is a more important principle, you know, than I ever knew. And then I finally made the connection as to why it was a continuous category running through everything. And why is that? What is the arbitrary? I actually say it in the book now, but in a chapter that you don't have. What is the arbitrary, the other side of, or the negative of? Well, I'm looking for a specific word. The arbitrary is that which is cut out from everything else, disconnected from everything, right? So it's the antonym of integration, right? And once you see that, then all the attacks on the arbitrary are really ways of pointing out the necessity of integration and cognition, you see. And then when that clicked, I suddenly realized that this was not just, you know, an interesting side idea that Ayn Rand had, but an absolutely essential expression of the essence of her approach to all of epistemology. Because what is a concept? A device for integrating sensory data. Her whole view of knowledge is integration. And when I tied the arbitrary to that, I thought, oh boy, I really get it now. So you'll probably see I keep bringing that up now because I was so happy with that point. Now, what else did I have to say here? Now, I want to point out to you on 292. Oh, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4. Does anybody have any confusion about this statement, the last sentence? A rational being's tool of survival is, not should be, but is. Do you understand why I say that and what I mean by that phrase in dashes? Not should be, but is. I'm trying to get different people, but I can only do it by hair color, unfortunately. Yeah.
Because it can't survive in any other way.
Well, then why couldn't I say his tool of survival should be his private mind? Yeah, okay, that's right. There's no alternative. What else did you want to say?
Should be is a value judgment, whereas this is a fact from reality.
Exactly. We are before value judgments here. We couldn't get to value judgments until we knew what this being is and how he survives. So if I, at this point, said, your tool of survival should be, the logical question would be, well, how, why? Why should it be? You say, well, I don't know, I've got to defend something. You would be completely stopped. But this point is, that's the way things are. So if you have any questions as to why, you have to address them to reality. Why did you invent things this way? Of course, there's no answer to that question. The irreducible fact is individuals exist and the process of reason exists only in an individual. That's it. There is no other way to operate it. So there's no point telling us that that should be true. It is true. It would be like saying It's exactly like saying every object should attract every other one with the force directly proportional to the, you know, the product of their masses, etc. Well, what's to whom are you saying that they should do it? I mean, either they do it or they don't do it, you know. And this is it's very important, therefore, I stress this. This is pre-ethics, yes.
Yes, I just want to relate this to something you said earlier today. You guys have just been colloquial at the time, but I could use the help of my own clarity. You were saying that volition precedes all philosophical advice.
Right.
Talk about epistemology. You should form concepts this way, but you really, the epistemology is really, it's factual at that point. It's not...
Well, that's a really good question. I said that volition precedes epistemology because epistemology is normative. It tells you how you should act. But he's saying, aren't there in fact some facts in epistemology that are not a question of simply describing what you should do? Oh, yes. And I'm glad you gave me a chance to correct that. The basic nature of a conceptual faculty, what the mind has to do, the omission of measurements, you know, takes place and has taken place through the ages, whether we know it or not. Nor do you have any choice about that. You couldn't say, well, I'm not going to omit measurements, I'll omit bananas instead. I mean, you know, that's just the way you are. In the same way, I couldn't tell you, you should use your senses this way rather than that. Don't see when you open your lids, you know. I mean, those things, all of those are facts that have to be described. The nature of the senses, the integration of sensation to percepts, and the essential nature of the conceptual faculty, including the fact that beyond that essential nature, it has choice. It has choice in everything it does with concepts, you see. And that's where, without choice, there's no place to go. Because even in concluding its concept formation, when you go beyond ostensive first-level concepts, you need definitions. And definitions is already normative. That is, it's based on the nature of concepts, but it tells you, you should do this, and people can violate it. You see, they can define by non-essentials or non-fundamentals or whatever. Wherever you reach the point where it is possible to do something wrong, then what the truth becomes advice as to what you should do. And in that sense, let me put it this way, the practical importance of epistemology is the advice it gives and presupposes volition. Although the base of epistemology, including above all the essential nature of concept formation, is factual, and you have no choice in regard to those. That's a good question, and I'm glad you asked that. Now, let's take one more. Page 292, the second last paragraph. You see the end of the sentence there, the individual is sovereign. You see the word sovereign? Now, is that an axiom? Now, there's all kinds of conservatives would say, yeah, the individual is sovereign, the master of his destiny, and so on. That's where we start. That's an axiom. Now here again, like in the other example, this is way down the chain, the individual is sovereign. Why? Well, I try to sketch to you in that sentence what it is it presupposes. It presupposes the power of reason in shaping your emotions, your actions, your character, your life. Because if reason were an impotent faculty, then it wouldn't make any difference whether you did or didn't exercise reason. Your life and so on would be a product of whatever, you know, factors acted upon you. So it presupposes the potency of reason, the fact that the choice to think controls everything else. And then, of course, whose reason? Well, then it's an attribute of the individual. That's why it could only be here. And of course, what is reason? Well, we had that whole thing. So you couldn't get to such a conclusion as the individual is sovereign until the end of the chapter on man. It's the last idea before you turn to ethics. It's the final summation. We now know man and what makes him tick, and etc. and so on. So now we can say he must be sovereign. And I must say, I like the part on the bottom of 293 on nature versus nurture. A corrupt alternative, if ever I heard one. And I think I expose, even though that's polemics, I expose it very well. And I would like to point out to you on 294, you cannot refute these theories merely by advocating, quote, free will. Do you understand that? There's a big debate in philosophy. Does man have free will, or is he determined? And there are, I know, objectivists who feel that if they encounter an ally, encounter someone who believes in free will, well, that's a real ally. But it isn't. Christians through the ages have believed in free will, and they have a completely different view. Existentialists believe in free will, I mean, in certain moods, anyway. Why? Why is it not enough to believe in free will? Yes.
Say what you are free to do.
What difference does it make? What exactly? What is the effects of this choice? Is it a potent choice or not? You're only the master of your destiny if your free will shapes your destiny. But if your destiny, for instance, is to be shaped by God, and your free will consists of periodically kneeling or not, you know, or going to church on Sunday or not, but you're still going on the same way anyway, and your emotions are the same way anyway, and your actions are the same way anyway, but your free will is just every once in a while to say, oh, to hell with it, I'll give in, no, I won't, which is the normal view of free will, then what the hell difference is free will? It's of no consequence. That's why Ayn Rand, to my knowledge, is the first one who made free will worth fighting for, because in her, it's inextricably tied to the choice to think, and thinking is what determines all the others, the emotions, the actions, the character, the life. And I think I put that very well in this sentence here in paragraph 3. Choice is not a mystic factor superimposed on a deterministic creature, which is exactly the religious view of free will. Man is essentially a determinist or a deterministic being, and then God gave him freedom which he can exercise miraculously now and then for no particular reason. And all of this paragraph is very well worded, very carefully worded, and if you know the history of philosophy, to make such a statement as reason is will would blow the minds of people who know 19th century philosophy, because the whole essence of that period was the people who advocated will versus the people who advocated reason. And they were at each other's throats. And of course, the existentialists in the old days, they're not around anymore, but they were the ones who were the advocates of will, and the analysts, so-called, are the ones that are the advocates of reason. And we still have that dichotomy. Now then, the only thing I'll point out here is the last little final overview of the chapter. Man is an organism of a distinctive kind. That's the nature of man. Living in a universe which has a definite nature, that's the nature of reality, chapter 1. His life depends on a cognitive faculty which functions according to specific rules. That's chapters 2 through 5. This faculty belongs to man the individual. That's the sequence we just read. What then should man do? And that is, in other words, in those few sentences we have the sum of all the facts that underlie value judgments. That's the whole book in four lines of type, or three lines, because then it becomes a question. Where do we go from here? So what? And then logically enough, the next chapter is the good. And that's where we'll pick up. Now we have about 5 minutes for questions. I guess I'll make them on any section, anything on the chapter that you want. I can't see. Well, I'm happy. Oh, there, you have to wave it. Yes, okay.
You said in a previous chapter that the faculty of volition is the same as the faculty of reason. There's only one faculty.
Yeah, it's the same point again, yeah. Oh, you read chapter 2?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm wondering if there's any other aspect of this faculty that you can just bring forth so we can tie it all together.
Well,
for me, that was a new light. So
yeah, it was to me too when Ms. Rand told it to me. Well, yeah, basically everything that your consciousness can do that's distinctively human, every faculty is the faculty of reason in some aspect or other. Reason is simply the name we give to the conceptual faculty. It's not synonymous with consciousness as such, because animals are conscious. And human beings can be conscious but drunk, where reason is dulled or, you know, numbed, but they still are conscious. But reason operates, is the name of the conceptual faculty broadly. Now, anything that faculty can do, that is the faculty of reason in a specific aspect. For instance, that faculty chooses, so reason is will. That faculty integrates, so reason is integration. That faculty identifies, so reason is identification. I mean, you see, depending on how you look at it, it's just the one faculty. But the one of the problems is that because we're able by abstraction to separate one function from another, people then hypostatize them, you know, reify them into separate entities, and then make, because of, you know, corrupt ideas like the mind-body dichotomy, they make a war between like reason and will or whichever, and or even reason versus integration. You know, there is such a dichotomy. The analysts, for instance, oppose any form of conceptual integration because they think that's necessarily mystical. Only mystics try to get an overview of the total. And they believe that because so many mystics did, you know, whereas empiricists didn't. So it just became a rule of thumb. You know, you can't integrate or you're mystical. And therefore, from that, they proudly call themselves analysts, meaning we take apart, but we won't put together. And so that's like reason versus will, only as applied to integration. And you could go through the whole history of philosophy that way, reason versus emotion. See, but the faculty of reason is the faculty of emotion, not of sensation. You see, which doesn't go through the conceptual faculty, but of emotion, it is. Only there, it's not the faculty in its primary use, but as a derivative, as a consequence of its content. So if you asked me to give you an inventory, I'd have to give you an inventory of everything reason does. And that would be hard to do. But I've covered quite a bit in the chapter. Now I understand that we have one more question. Now before there was no questions, and now I've got all kinds. All right, who has not asked a question so far? You for sure have. Yes, okay.
Yes, on the issue of integration, what does it do to the, or how can objectivism advocate the correspondence theory of truth, which seems to require only reduction, if it also...
Only what?
Reduction.
Oh, yeah.
Correspond to the fact of the facts of reality, and...
Well, you're asking a question that is technically way back in chapter 4, but I'll answer anyway briefly. He's saying, how can you demand integration and still advocate the correspondence theory of truth? Because if you advocate the correspondence theory of truth, that means each statement is true because it corresponds to reality, so you should reduce each statement back to reality. When you bring in integration, aren't you committed to another theory of truth, namely Hegel's, the coherence theory? No, you certainly are not. Because the question becomes, how do we know reality? If you could take any one idea and without reference to any others go directly to reality with it, that would mean every idea would be a primary, there would be no hierarchical structure, and there would be no need then to integrate. It would be just like on the perceptual level. For instance, you could validate any percept by just opening your eyes and looking. You go directly from, you perceive, and there it is, that's all there is to it. But the whole thing about concepts is that they are formed in a context, built on preceding ones, and the only way you can grasp their meaning is to connect them to the context on successively more abstract levels. So you are trying to correspond to reality, but your only way of corresponding to reality is by going through a complex process of interrelationships to other ideas, which themselves are related to others until you finally reach the bedrock axis. In other words, it's integration as a means to correspondence. And there's no idea that there is a world of ideas which, you know, just exists apart from any reality. There's nothing remotely like that. Now, I'd like to pursue that, but you're way into epistemology, and we are supposed to be here on, as a matter of fact, we're at the end. So next time, we're going to do chapter 7, The Good. Thank you.